You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos, and beyond.
Hi, I'm Alexander Baldessare, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show! Yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Alexander Baldessare. He's the author of The Man Who Saw Seconds. Hi, Alexander.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Yeah? And where am I talking to you from on this distant earth?
Vancouver, BC, so quite distant from most of the world.
Yeah. How long have you lived in Vancouver?
15 years. Mm-hmm. It's actually the longest I've lived anywhere. I used to change countries every couple of years, basically, at least cities. But yeah. I kind of got tired. I got tired of being that skipping stone on the surface of the water. And I just happened to be here when I got tired. So this is where I settled down.
So how were you able to pull off being the skipping stone to different countries?
Well, I was born in Slovakia at the time, Czechoslovakia. We defected. It was an old school kind of Cold War defection. We were spent 6 months in a refugee camp in Austria. Canada took us in.
What year was that?
We escaped in 79 and came to Canada in 1980.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm dating myself there. But
I'm dating myself, too. I'm single.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, that's good. I'm a big fan of puns. So then we came to Canada. I went to high school in Canada, moved to Montreal. Part of it was when I was 15, my mom came into my room and got really angry with me one summer and said, we didn't escape so you would stay in Canada. And we escaped so you'd have the opportunity to travel and see the world. So at 16, I started, I bicycled from Paris to Athens at 16. 17, I went to Africa for the first time. So I started traveling really early. And yeah. I thought I wanted that to be my life. I thought I wanted to keep changing countries and cultures and languages every few years. And so I kind of followed through with that. I practiced international trade law for a while, for a very short while. And then I quit to write books, moved first to Nepal, then to Indonesia, then to New York City. My son was born in New York, then back to Indonesia. And then my first wife had a schizophrenic breakdown. Wow. And so she needed mental health care. And so we came to Vancouver. I wanted to move back to Canada for the healthcare.
Yeah.
And she was from Tennessee, so she wasn't going to put up with Montreal. I loved Montreal. I loved the culture there. But
it's got more French over there, right?
It's got more French, and it's kind of halfway between Europe and North America in terms of the mindset. But yeah, she wasn't going to put up with minus 40. So Vancouver, I showed her Vancouver had the same temperature averages as Nashville. And so we came here. I didn't know anybody here. She didn't know anybody here. Neither of us had been to visit. And we thought, okay, that's a compromise. And then a couple of years later, she moved back to Tennessee anyway. So my son and I stayed. And I wanted him to have kind of a stable home growing up. Now he's moved to Amsterdam for university now. So
the ancestor genes seem to be everyone travels.
Yeah.
So what's your first language? What was the language spoken in Slovakia?
Slovak. I actually learned Hungarian and Slovak at the same time as a little kid because my grandmother, even though she was ethnically Slovak, she only spoke Hungarian. She was still from the Austria-Hungary days. Funny aside, the city she was born in belonged to five countries during the span of her life. But now it's in Ukraine. But so my first languages were Slovak and Hungarian. I don't remember any Hungarian other than how to swear. But it's a very good language for swearing, apparently. Slovak and then Czech, because all the TV, everything was in Czech. A lot of the textbooks in school. Then German in the refugee camp. So chronologically, English was my fifth.
Yeah.
But Slovak is a very good base for languages. You end up, it's so complicated. It's actually in the Guinness Book of World Records as that most difficult language.
Really?
That's a very subjective ranking because it depends on what your base is. But it has, you know, multiple. You can have 160 different endings based on declensions and stuff like that. In English, you have who and whom. You know,
right.
So it made learning additional languages a lot easier. And then once you learn a few early on, I think you learn how to learn languages.
And what is, can you verbalize the secret to that? Or is there just kind of like your brain's just trained to be open to how languages, how they work?
I think I can verbalize it partially. I've always thought of it as soon as I go into a new country, I try to think of it as a new gear. And, you know, at the beginning, the gear is very rough, but I try to only think and speak in the language that I'm trying to learn. And if I don't know the vocabulary, I'll just use the English vocabulary with the grammar endings that I've learned from the new language. And as I accumulate more vocabulary, I just swap it out. But that creation of the new gear is the key. Instead of trying to translate from English or whatever your base language is, instead of trying to translate at every point, you really have to create that new gear. Now there are limits to that. I've always struggled, for example, with poetry. I enjoy reading it, but I just don't have the lyrical ear in English. And I remember I read an interesting study or that the lyrical aspect of language is learned at about age 3 or by age 3. And so you see a lot of great writers like, you know, Conrad, Nabokov, who write in a second language, but you very rarely see poets. Like Rilke maybe wrote in French to some extent, but you rarely see poets who excel in a second language. And I've kind of hit on that when I just, you know, experimenting as a writer, I tried my hand at writing poetry and it never felt right. Like I just don't have quite the ear for the musicality of English.
I see. I was trying to write poetry in English and I'm just a bad poet. So it's just like, this isn't working. I thought it was working. I, you know, when you have that young, you're just like, I'm going to take over the world. Everyone's going to realize what a great poet I am. And then you look back at it and you're like, well, that's a cute little fella. He didn't know.
Maybe for me, it's a convoluted excuse for why I'm also a bad poet. It's quite possible.
Hungarian is supposed to be a very hard language to learn, especially for English speakers, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think in part it's because it's not Indo-European. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Finno-Ugric. And so the structure is very different.
Yeah.
By far, for me, the most difficult language is Japanese because it was so different from the other languages I'd learned.
And did you also learn the characters and the how to read Japanese too, or no?
I did when I lived in Japan because I also lived in, I mean, I skipped a few steps there in moving around. But when I got to about 2,000 characters, using this guy, Robert Heisig, has a very good book that it's a very different way of learning characters. Instead of trying to learn as a child from rote repetition, you create meanings for the elements within the character and you create stories for how to build them together. But that faded. I mean, it's amazing how much I've lost. Like the characters are just gone. I remember a small handful, but after I left Japan, like at the time I had my job was speaking Japanese full time. My girlfriend only spoke Japanese. I was fully immersed. And after I moved to Indonesia, weirdly, that metaphor of the gears, I also think maybe at least my brain only has a limited number of slots for gears. And so when I learned Indonesian, it almost overwrote Japanese. And when I'd start speaking to a Japanese person, I would get to a point where I wouldn't know which language I was speaking. The vocabulary was completely scrambled. And I couldn't tell if the word that was coming out was Indonesian or Japanese. And so that created, it was almost like the last language I'd learned was that those gears are just getting swapped out. The earlier languages, those are solid, but the most recent languages were just, the weakest languages were swapping out.
But at least you have that foundation, so you're totally adaptable. I'm sure if you went to Japan today, you'd probably be right back. That gear would be back in within a month.
It would take me a month, I think, yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I'm like, I take Spanish lessons, and it's It's interesting because my Spanish tutor, he's, you know, we tr immediately we are speaking in Spanish, you know, but of course he's going slow for me because I try to speak Spanish in Los Angeles and I'm like, whoa, okay, let me, but you have a good eye, you have a, when you're thinking in the language, it's so much different than when you're translating. It's such a, I feel like that's kind of been the key, even many years ago when I, you know, this is in the 90s when I went to France a couple times and I was trying to learn French, but I would think in French instead of translate. And so then that kind of shifted. That was the way that it shifted gears in my very limited way. And I've been kind of a lazy Spanish student, and which is just terrible because I teach as well, and I hate being the lazy student. When you're, and because at the same time it gives me empathy for my lazy students, so maybe that's good. But after I tried, like I would try to set up my you know, just scheduling wise, I'd have my hour with my Spanish tutor, and then I'd tape Drinks with Tony after. And it took me about 15 minutes to be able to think in English again, even though,
Podemos hablar en español si quieres.
yeah.
No, but Spanish is complicated. I can't imagine doing it in LA because it depends. I mean, the Spanish from Cuba, I can't understand C Cubans.
Yeah.
A Colombian or somebody from Spain, because I learned Castilian, so the Spanish from Spain is the most natural to me. But Cuban for Colombian, for example, so clean that
Yes.
it's easy. When I go to Cuba, I can't understand anyone.
Yeah.
So it's
My tutor's in Colombia. So
okay.
I specifically picked that one because just how regional, but when I'm in you know, in Los Angeles, I'm talking to Mexicans and El Salvadorians, and
Yeah.
so, but you know, and they put up with my hey, buenas tardes, okay. But it's so different when I'm talking to my tutor because immediately he's making me speak Spanish, and I'm just like, oh. And then it takes me a little bit, and then I'm in the game, and then we're learning
Yeah.
verb conjugations yet again.
Well, the other way to do it as a lazy person is just watch Netflix in Spanish. Like
Yeah.
I've Spanish is my most recent language that I'm trying to learn. So I've just been watching all my Netflix, like guilty TV, you know, that kind of mindless TV that you watch. It's so easy to just put the Spanish on for the language and then English as a subtitle. And so you get the ear for it.
Yes. And when I drive, since I'm in LA, half the radio stations are in Spanish. I only listen to Spanish radio.
Yeah.
So I know a lot, and I get, you know, I get mostly the commercials are about injury lawyers, right? Jama cinco 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 tres. And I'm just, you know, and I'm like, oh wow. I'm like learning how to call injury lawyers in Los Angeles in case I get into a car accident.
The music's probably better as well, so.
It's pretty cool, yeah. I need to. There's a one station, I forget what station it is, but I need to start downloading their playlist because I like their artist and just get those artists in my rotation on my head so I can start learning the music. So I'm not totally into the ranchero type Mexican. That's
Yeah.
kind of not my vibe. But there's one station that's, I don't know if it's trap music is what they call it, but it's just there's something where it's like really pleasing to my ear, and I'm like, oh, I need to find out all who all of these artists are and just get all of their albums. So, and so how old were you when you were in the refugee camp in Austria?
I had my 8th birthday in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in at 7 and left at 8.
When you're that young and you're in that situation, what did Or did you feel a lot of fear, or was it kind of like, oh, the world is, you know, what was your status quo to what the world of safety was versus what you were going through? Did you feel kind of like taken care of and we're just moving on?
I thought it was great because I didn't have school for a year. So
It great to be 8 years old?
my parents were a lot more stressed, and we started off in this really bad camp. It was like 50 people to a room, and there was my brother almost lost his leg just from One guy had thrown another guy out the windows and the broken glass everywhere. My brother cut his leg. He was a year and a half. My brother was a year and a half old, and he got a cut. There were no doctors there. He got an infection, and there was nobody to kind of help him. There was a camp nurse, but she just put a Band-Aid on, and he ended up getting a very bad infection that when he finally got evacuated to Vienna for surgery, the surgeon said if they'd waited one more hour, they probably would have had to amputate the leg.
Wow.
And that surgeon got very angry about the conditions in the camp. And he pushed through that we got into a special camp for families, which was instead of 50 people to a room, it was two rooms for the four of us. And it was up in the Alps. And so that for me was a blast. I was just playing in the Austrian Alps. I actually used a one tiny bit in the book, in The Man Who Saw Seconds. I have a spot where the fact that when they're in northern Canada, take a mattress, wrap it in plastic, and fly, go tobogganing. That's what we were doing in the Alps through the winter. We were tobogganing on plastic covered mattresses, and that was, I mean, I don't think I've still ever gone that fast on a trip to toboggan. So for me, it was just a lot of fun. For my parents, it was stressful, especially because my dad had been in the special forces, and he was there were stories of the Secret Service services, the security organs kidnapping people to get, like kidnapping kids to force the parents back. And so, a couple of times I stayed out past dark. I had a curfew of nighttime, and I remember getting a few beatings for being out past curfew, and it was more serious there than it would be in a normal situation. But it was like they were stressed. For me as a kid, it was just fun. There was absolutely no trauma involved. It was just a blast.
Do you with the other kids that you were hanging out with for your year off, for your gap year at 8 years old, do you still keep in contact with any of those people or?
Not really. There was a Polish boy that was my age, and he spoke Polish, I spoke Slovak. We could understand each other. He ended up immigrating to New York, and we stayed in touch for about 10, 20 years after, but then it kind of faded.
Oh, that's cool. And then
Which is
your
funny because I lived in New York. I lived in New York for a while, and I never looked him up. I actually didn't think of it until way too late now.
It's so interesting, the chapters in our lives and the people that are in our lives in certain chapters, and then they go by the wayside, and it's sometimes it's just like, oh wow, drifted apart. Sometimes it's like, oh wow, glad I'm not in touch with that person anymore.
Well, I really feel like I'm a different person every decade. I don't think I'm the same person in my 20s, 30s, 40s. I'm 52 now, so it's weirdly like the chapters really feel like my wife died. My second wife died when I was 50, so 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And so like there are these massive inflection points that happen, and they really do define kind of the chapters of your life. So it I've never liked those memes that say, discover who you are. It's like, no, you create who you are, and hopefully it's not the same person that you were 10 years ago. Yes.
As I get older, I have more empathy for, my grandparents are dead. But when I was younger, you used to think old people were like, oh yeah, they don't know nothing, But once you go through like experiences of victories and also major losses, it's just like that is when we're put to the test is our character, and how do we get through it? Which I mean, it's which essentially is the beauty of being writers, because we're storytellers and bringing our characters through these major conflicts and getting them out of them. And it's like, oh wow, it's the human condition is just us in life, much more slowed down than a book or a film. But it's.
No, but absolutely, I 100% agree with you, but that's the power of writing. And you can take, I mean, the emotional energy in The Man Who Saw Seconds, this idea of the father protecting his son. None of the fact pattern is true to what happened, but I mean, I kind of skimmed over with the mental breakdown of my first wife, but my son was abducted for a week when he was four. And like the enamel melted off 14 of my teeth from stress. just
Wow.
from clenching my it was a very stressful moment, hour or time period. But as a writer, you can take that and turn it into something positive. You can turn it into like energy for a story. And again, none of the fact pattern remains, but accessing that feeling of, you know, trying to protect your kid, it gives a story so much more life than if it's completely abstracted out. And so, yeah, that's the gift of being a writer, or that's the emotional gift. The intellectual gift is being able to put yourself into, you know, completely different people
Yeah.
from the inside. Like, I think there's no other art form where you really get to come in from the inside. In movies, you're still, no matter how good the movie is, you're still seeing the character from the person from the outside. And I think, I mean, I don't want to get political, but we all could use the more of that fiction ability to see the world through dramatically different backgrounds, identities, worldviews, politics, ethics, moralities. Like the and fiction's, I think, the only place where you really truly get that you're possessing a different person.
Yeah, I feel like I learn more from reading literature, like classic literature. I just finished The Count of Monte Cristo for the first time, and it's just like I feel like I learn more about that era and have more insight into the humanity of it than being told about the Napoleon years and the it's you know and what and the aftermath of that. It's a beautiful. I just feel like that's when there's more truth in novels than there is in often nonfiction because we get the emotional truth and we also get the little tidbits of everyday life that it's we go, oh wait, of course that makes sense because they didn't have access to blank. They didn't. They and it wasn't like they sat there and went, I didn't have access to GPS. That's why I couldn't make it over there. They're just. It's and it's like then it then I bring myself to this moment in time where it's just like the tw we're in 2024 and there's going to be a time where they'll be like, wow, they didn't have access to blank. It's so crazy how they navigated the world with only GPS and their iPhones. Who does that? These ancient technologies.
Yeah, it's the same reason that when I travel, if I'm in Paris, I don't go see the Eiffel Tower. I go sit in a cafe and talk to people. And it's a very different type of travel, but I think you get so much more from just hanging out and talking to random people at a grocery store and cafe than you do from visiting the Eiffel Tower.
Oh,
It,
so
like,
much. Yeah. And even I like doing laundry at laundromats
yeah.
when I'm traveling. That's where you're just sitting there with people that are bored out of their minds and they're going, "Wait, why are you in this laundromat in this neighborhood and you're not from here in any way at all?" And you're just like, "Now we get to talk." It's good fun. What was it like when you so you bicycled from from Paris to Greece. I mean, what was that trek like? How long did that take?
That took, it was 3,000 kilometers, and it took basically a month, so roughly 100 kilometers a day.
You
But that
did
was
like,
again, I was 16 at the time. That was a long time ago.
yeah.
We ended up taking a boat through down through Yugoslavia. It took a boat around Albania, so there was a little stretch that was done by boat. But yeah, it was fun. It was still Yugoslavia when it was before the war.
Yeah.
Again, that was just like the first trip I took on my own. I remember hitting over 100 kilometers an hour down the Alps, just flying
Oh my
down the
God.
Alps on
Yeah.
a bicycle.
Yeah.
And then I did another bicycle trip when my little brother turned 16. And by then, my parents had become a lot more Canadian, and they were scared. Like, he was 16, he wanted to go travel on his own, and they're like, "No, you have to go with your brother." And so we went through Norway and Sweden. That was 5,000 kilometers, and after, I never sat on a bicycle again. I bought a motorcycle. I liked my accelerator.
Yeah.
It was much easier. But then, when my brother, when my son turned 16, he wanted to go. Or at 15, he was like, "I'm gonna be 16 next summer. I want to go travel." And I was like, "Oh, that was a very different time, very different era." And he said, "Yeah, now we have cell phones." And I'd always promised him if he could make a good counter argument, I changed my mind. So I thought, okay. So he went at 16, backpacking around Europe, you know, it was 2 years ago. And there were some hostels that actually kicked him out because he was too young. And so he had to sleep on the bench because, like, you know, the way w weird way the way rules work sometimes is so idiotic.
Yeah.
So, you know, for his own safety, they kicked him out of the hostel that he had a reservation for at the last minute, so he couldn't find a place to stay. And just to pull it back to the novel, like, that's one of the intellectual themes in the book, is that institutions become counterproductive to their own purpose. You know, it comes from the Austrian philosopher Ivan Illich, that his concept of counterproductivity.
Yeah.
And the obvious example is things like, you know, ministries of defense declaring wars, or schools making kids stupid, or hospitals being the number three cause of death, like hospital error. Even something like a car that creates the remoteness that it's built to overcome. But also, in a lot of ways, our safety obsession. I'm not a fan of safety. Our safety mindset sometimes does things like, you know, for a kid's own safety, they're not going to let him stay there. But anyway, he had a blast. It was really good for him. He, you know, he learned a lot. Like, he's super mature for his age, because I've always pushed independence. But it was fun that it was still possible. Like, even in 2022 at the time, you know, a 16-year-old could go get a Uriel pass and backpack around Europe. Like, it's, we haven't completely lost that spirit.
Yeah, and just immersing into other cultures. And the most beautiful part, it's, you know, I have the minimal that I've traveled to other countries. I always find the when I'm utterly frustrated and everything's going wrong in that moment, that always becomes the best travel story that I had from that trip.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's just
Yeah.
like so it's there's it's a beautiful reminder that even when it seems like everything's going wrong, that, well, we get one, we're resilient, and two, what a fun story.
Who was it? That's a pretty established concept, that there's the experiencing self and the remembering self. And the experiencing self might not enjoy the difficulty, but the remembering self, kind of, that's the most meaningful moment. And it's almost like we have two different selves, like experiencing in the moment and then looking back on the memory. So you kind of have to ask yourself, which one am I traveling for? Which self is on this trip? And I think it's nice to have a little bit of both. Like, it's nice to have some relaxing times, but yeah, for especially when you're young, you want to build building those memories and those experiences that shape who you are.
Yeah. And then that kind of brings up, I just think of the idea of when we're in those stressful situations, can we bring to our mind, oh, this will be a remembering moment. You know,
Yeah.
wait, oh wait, this is like even when you're you know, you when we take comedy out of tragedy, but you're in the middle of a tragedy, you can't take comedy out of it, but how fast can you take comedy out of it? Or go,
Yeah.
this will be funny one day, even though this is like the worst day of my life.
Well, I used to teach comedy workshops, and
Oh, you did?
briefly, yeah,
Yeah.
more satire, but the idea that comedy is tragedy plus time,
Yeah.
and the less time, the more edgy it is.
Yeah.
So, but, and if you shrink the time too much, some people get upset with you.
Right. And it's beautiful. It's such a beautiful art form. That it's it, the ones that get upset with it, it's those comedians that do like really like push that line, and the ones that like find the way to do it and the way to
Yeah.
come around it. I was, you know, the speaking of not getting political, there was a there was a I think it was Louis C was it Louis C.K. about he had a joke about abortion recently. It was either it was Louis C.K. or I think it was Louis C.K. and he said, look, I'm going full pro-choice, but here's the caveat: when and you abort your baby whenever, I don't mind, but you have to eat it when you abort it. So that kind of that's like a wow, because it would be a lot harder to eat an 8-month-old baby than it would to eat a smaller fetus, right?
That's
And And it's just like, that's just that angle of, you know, because especially now with politics are using like that as one of the main, I don't know, from what I see, I try to stay away from politics as much as possible. I kind of just look over, glance over and go, oh, that's interesting. And then I turn back to like, you know, actual real life.
Yeah.
I don't have any of these people as deities in my.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to politics, there's a trend toward being lectured in our entertainment. And I don't want to be told what to think, even when I agree with the prescription. Even if I'm 100% on the same side, I don't like to be told what to think. And when I write, I really try hard. I mean, Seconds has political undertones in the sense of this one guy fighting against the entire system. But I never want to give answers. I just want to frame questions in interesting ways. And I think that's a lot more respectful of your reader. I'm not here to lecture people. I'm not here to tell them what to think. But I think good writers do have the ability to open up. Like that Louis C.K. joke. You know, there is an element of it creates a completely different angle for looking at an issue. And that ability to reframe questions, I think it's very valuable to be constantly reframing how we look at questions and clashing different ideas against each other, again, without giving the solution. Just let the people feel, I mean, you know, with in The Man Who Saw Seconds, what Preble has to do to kind of defend his family keeps getting more and more extreme. It keeps escalating, and different readers have followed for different lengths of time. Many go with him all the way. Other people were like, whoa, that's too far. And I've, like in interviews, I completely avoid saying where I think the line is, because as an author, it's too heavy a thumb on the scale. But it has been really fascinating to see how different people will track with him for a different length of time, as his initially completely understandable, and maybe all the way through completely understandable motivations, become more and more like require more and more extreme actions on his part. And that's half the fun for me, seeing how far different readers go.
It's beautiful. And that's when you know you've done it right.
Yeah. And it definitely isn't just one spot. Like, it really is a huge variance. I mean, sometimes I'm surprised how early readers turned against him. And other times I'm surprised at who had absolutely no problem going all the way to the end with him. That's where it becomes kind of a conversation instead of just writing into the void, right?
Yeah. And it's beautiful that you keep it to yourself too, because we don't want to push our narrative of our relationship with our books on the other people, because once that book is published and out there, it's almost like our relationship is over. And we've broken up with that person. We've broken up with even who we were as we were writing it. And then now it's for other people.
I'm a huge fan of, there's a quote by Umberto Eco that says, the author should die once he has finished writing so as not to trouble the path of the text.
And that's good.
And I really, really like that. I think that once that book is out there, it's hands off for me.
Yeah.
I'm happy to talk about it. And in interviews, people are often asking about kind of personal, the personal background. And I used to be an art critic, and in visual art, it's even stronger, this idea of this personal mythology and all that. But I'm at a different school of thought. I really think that it needs to work as its own thing, and it doesn't belong to me once it's out.
Yeah. And it's kind of hard. I don't know if you've had this, but I have a hard time letting go. Like, it's almost because when you're working with characters for so long, and I mean, it's just crazy how these characters become your most intimate. For me, they're my most intimate relationships because I'm with them 4 hours a day. Who else am I with for 4 hours a day when I'm working on a book? You know, so these people are very real to me. And then you have to go, see you later. I got nothing else to do with you. And it's just like, I don't have a kid, but it almost feels like I'm kicking a kid out into the world. And it's just like, here's a pack of cigarettes, here's some booze, here's some money to go, you know, just get a drug habit, and I'll never see you again.
but being, I think it's important to have that openness to other people having their own interpretations. Like, again, pulling it back to art, Rembrandt, you know, all the Rembrandts that we remember are from his later period. Like, all the best Rembrandt pieces are from his second half. And big change he made. I mean, it sounds funny to us now because they all look kind of similar to a modern eye. They all seem realistic. But he really loosened up his brushstrokes. And just that idea of just loosening up, at the time, he was kind of hammered for it. It was not popular. But those are the ones that survived the test of time because that looseness, that opening up of the space for the viewer is what created the engagement. And I think the same with characters. Like, if you make a character that's, I mean, writing is almost impossible because words are not bricks. You know, they're kind of plastic bags that everybody fills with their own meaning. But by creating that openness, you allow readers to engage on their own. And then it becomes a book that, instead of finishing it and forgetting it the next day, people think about. And again, that to me is, even though I'm writing thrillers, I want to write a book that people will think about a month later. And for that, I think it does require a looser approach.
I grew up a preacher. I grew up in a very dogmatic belief system. And I actually was a guy that knocked on doors with my Bible and preached when I was young, up into my mid-20s. So I'm very cognizant of never, ever wanting to preach. And also, when I'm reading a book, I can tell right away if I'm being preached to, or sometimes I can tell the author's being dishonest. I don't know exactly. And that's something I don't know how to verbalize. And I don't even know if it's not necessarily dishonesty, but it's almost like they're not in tune with their authenticity and it's bleeding into the book.
Yeah.
I don't know if you find that too, or because this might be something that's just in my brain that may not even be correct. It could be one of the craziest things in the world.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting, even though I read a lot, I haven't thought of it as much in terms of writing as back when I was an art critic. You could see it really quickly in visual art. You know, you could see it when somebody, that kind of dishonesty, you know, somebody saw something that's popular and they're imitating their style, or their something about the art feels derivative, and it's just tapping into a moment or a popularity. And I'm not sure if that's what you mean by the dishonesty in writing, but yeah, I totally understand that intuition, and it is something that's hard to pin down, like, exactly, but right. It just comes across kind of the "I know it when I see it" idea.
Yeah, and I think people who, like, you know, there's people, and I mean, we're kind of here to serve people who just want to enjoy reading, right? It's like, yeah. they don't have to like know how excruciating the process is and how what, you know, it's just like, oh, now it's out there and it's, you don't get the parade that you thought you would get. You just, people just go, oh, now it's publication day, and it's just like, oh, this kind of means nothing. But they don't need to know any of that. They just need to enjoy it or not enjoy it. And so it's, you know, I don't ever want to put a lot of responsibility on readers. But at the same time, I think if there is that, what we see when we're reading a book is like, oh, there's something that's not quite authentic of the authentic self. We can kind of understand, I guess, why we don't like it. Well, and they would just go, oh, this book's weird, and put it aside and not have much more thought, which they shouldn't have much more thought. There's no reason, you know.
They're giving us 8 to 10 hours of their life. That's a big ask in this day and age. Asking somebody to give you, you know, 10 hours of their life, you better be giving them something back.
Yeah.
Like entertainment, you know, interesting ideas, mostly entertainment. But yeah.
And I think I really feel like, I mean, people are scared about some people. They, who are they? I got no idea. But they say that, you know, people, it's like, oh, the novel is dying, TikTok is blah, blah, blah. And part of me is just like, no, I think the novel is going to go, the medium of the novel is going to only get stronger because people want that. I mean, I crave it. So maybe I'm just hope. Maybe this is just hope too. Who knows? But I crave to spend that much time in an author's head. I love it. It's a conversation I can have for 2 weeks with this author, and the author doesn't even know he's having a conversation with me. And
if people are willing to listen to 3-hour podcasts, which they are, they'll read books if the book is giving them something that they want. And I think it's on us as the writers to give the readers, that's why I do like playing with ideas a lot. I mean, a lot of my own motivation for writing is to play with ideas. But I know it has to be subsumed within a really entertaining plot, like a really fast paced action, because that's what most readers want. They want, you know, a fun action based thriller. And you can completely build ideas into the characters, into as long as they're consistent with the character motivations, as long as you're not, you know, lecturing the reader as a narrator. But build it into the actual action and the people, into their personalities, and then have the people clash it out. One of the, we kind of skip talking about the book initially, but The Man Who Saw Seconds is about this guy who can see 5 seconds into the future. And people have asked me about why 5 seconds, or they asked me if it's derivative of the Nicolas Cage movie Next. But I think there's a massive difference between, well, first of all, Next was based on a Philip K. Dick book or story, The Golden Man, which people seem to leave out. And they, and the Seconds does owe a much bigger debt to Philip K. Dick. But there's a massive difference between 2 minutes and 5 seconds. Or in Next, you could sometimes see a full day when the Jessica Biel character was involved. But as soon as you open that window too much, you end up creating overpowered main character. It's like Superman without kryptonite. If you can see the future for weeks on out, then nothing can stop you. You know, you're unstoppable.
Yeah.
And so what writers who write that kind of fiction have to do, they have to limit the foresight to glimpses, you know, special moments. But those glimpses are basically hidden deus ex machina, because that author is choosing what's the convenient glimpse to give to the character to make the plot go where I want to. And I've always felt a little bit allergic to kind of the deus ex machina authorial thumb on the scale. And so by keeping the precognition to 5 seconds, I can make it consistent and then let it just play out. So I didn't have to be, again, as the author, interfering. Like I could set up the dynamic where it's Preble Jefferson against, you know, all the security organs of the Western world in the end. And I could kind of stay out of it and just let it that clash. I just made sure there was no off ramp, and just I set up the scenario. I took away all off ramps, and then let's see where this would go. Now, starting with this tiny little incident on the subway to start, just escalate and escalate and escalate, without having that kind of authorial, or at least visible. Obviously, I'm still writing the book, but the minute you have the author choosing which parts of the future the character can see, to me, that feels heavy-handed. But by keeping it a consistent attribute, it really allowed, it was just enough, like the slim superpower, to give him a fighting chance against all the institutions of the world. And I just want to set up, you know, really close potential competition, and then let the ideas play out as they would. And so I never had to talk about politics or institutions or anything like that. I just set up the game in a way that it all played out through the plot. And that's where the fun for me comes through. Like, I, in a sense, as I'm writing it, obviously as the author, I'm creating the scenarios, but then seeing how it plays out, to me, is like 80% of the fun. It's like I'm exploring myself. And yeah, for me, that's a lot more fun.
The book I've been working on is very similar, where I've just put this character in these kind of situations that are of another world, and I'm like, I don't know how he gets out of this, and it's almost like it's kind of like, oh, I'm having much more fun than the reader will ever have, you know, if it never sees the light of day, as all of our books may never see the light of day. You're just sitting there, you know, that probably will, but at the same time, I'm I gotta entertain myself through the process. And if I'm entertaining myself, then usually that means someone else might be entertained.
Yeah, that's how I feel too.
Yeah. That's wait, when did you oh well, no, I had another question because these are all very selfish questions for me that I want to know. So you're in Vancouver. What would be the second place, because you've been all over the world and you've lived so many places, what would be the other place that you would just live in one hot second if you had the door open right now and it just said you could move Vancouver and you can move here and it won't have any cause and effect of your life other than moving to this lovely location that you were in during this period?
Oh, I struggle with decontextualized questions like that because it depends so much. Like my son now started school in Amsterdam,
Yeah.
and so just to be close to him, I've been spending a month or two in the winters in Spain, and so
Oh,
he
okay.
just so you can fly
Yeah.
down in 2 hours,
Right.
and I really enjoy Spain.
Yeah. What part of Spain?
Well, last winter I was in Alicante. But again, it was mostly just because I want to be on the beach and with an airport, and I do enjoy the beach, but mostly it was just the Spanish are so social and so friendly, and then Vancouver people try so hard to be polite that they never talk to each other, never make eye contact, and
Yeah.
that in seeking politeness they become really rude. Whereas in Spain it's so interactive, and you're constantly talking to people, and you see families every Sunday. There's massive families, just everything's shut down, and it's just a really kind of I really like that lifestyle. I lived in New York for 4 years. I was just there for a reading at the Mysterious Bookshop, and yeah, I missed, like, here in Vancouver we have some of the best nature in the world, but we have no culture. New York, there's no nature, but every night we were listening to Smalls for jazz, R&B the next night, Broadway play. Just, and I remember my writing group when I was in New York. It was all, people who wrote for New York or New York Review of Books. I can't recreate that here in Vancouver. But 5 minutes from my house, I have a mountain and I can walk and I won't hit another human being until Alaska. And there's beautiful mountain lakes that, so it's so contextual what, like, I loved living in Prague. I really enjoyed my time in San Francisco. Like these different places that I've lived, I've really enjoyed. But in the end, to me, it comes down to people. Like the city is always secondary. I mean, everything in life in the end comes down to people. And so my son just moved out, so I don't want to be breathing down his neck. I want him to have that, independent time. That's why I didn't go to Amsterdam. I went to Spain so he could choose when he came down. But yeah, it's hard for me to just choose a city based on a city that's kind of decontextualized from the people.
It's and as I've continued to grow up, I don't feel like I'll ever grow up, but I keep learning that just how much we are a reflection of the people we're around or the city we're around, because we're so even how we imitate each other and how our language can change. Even from cities like San Francisco to LA, there's different ways to say certain things, and all of a sudden you just adapt and you're saying it like it's no big problem. But we're such imitators of each other, and we mirror each other all the time, and that worries me sometimes, because then I feel like, well, I'm in my Los Angeles bubble, right? And so, of course, I'm mirroring the person that's physically in front of me, not on social media. Because as I walk through and navigate the streets and the roads of Los Angeles, I'm mirroring Los Angeles. I'm not, and it and in like places like San Francisco and Prague, I love Prague. I was in Prague for about 10 days in 1996.
I was there in 96 as well.
Oh, I might have seen you.
Yeah,
Oh, it
but
was gorgeous.
there's a lot to be said for the idea that you can't really understand your culture until you've been outside of it. And I think if I have one superpower in my writing, it really is because I've lived in so many different places that you know, like a good comic. A good comic can kind of see the culture from the outside and see its absurdities. And I think by having lived in lots of different places where the mindset and the culture is different, but on a very much on the level, like you said, like when my son came from Amsterdam, he, you know, we went to grocery store. He's here right now for the summer for a few weeks. And we went to grocery and he was like, I didn't realize how friendly, you know, grocery store clerks are. Because in Europe, grocery store clerks don't talk to you.
Right.
You know, it's all very kind of, for lack of a better word, cold. Those interactions are very functional.
Yeah.
Whereas here, if you're going to a grocery store, people will say hi. Like the grocery store, the clerk will just say, hey, how are you today? You know, stuff like that, which would be weird in Europe. Like, I had a Finnish girlfriend for 4 years and she was a professor. And I told her once, oh, you never smile. And when we're in public. And she said, well, I don't want people thinking I'm stupid. You know, in Finland, if you smile, you can't be a professor if you smile. Like, this is an assumption that if you smile, you're stupid.
Wow. And
so just these little tiny nuggets of insights into, and you can't see, for example, just how I always think of Vancouver as being kind of cold, but compared to a European perspective, you know, the cashiers still talk to you.
Yeah.
And you can't really see a culture until you've been outside of it.
Yeah.
And I think as a writer, like all my writing has a very slight absurdist tinge. I mean, before we started, we're talking about Bohumil Hrabal.
Yeah.
And even though I write in English, I do have that little bit of an absurdist sensibility, that Central European. I write English like a Czech writer would. And North American audience don't always fully get it because it's not magical realism in the, you know, in a South American style where people start levitating away. It's just these scenarios, like, you know, the king of Ethiopia coming to your hotel, or sorry, I don't know how far you've gotten into England.
Yeah, I'm bouncing between that and another book right now. And I mean, there's, well, not to break your thought, but I just love like Czech literature. I mean, it's, you know, when I read like Kundera or just any of these people. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think, sort of like you were talking about having been a preacher, that there's something about communism and the total control that they wanted over people's lives that created this absurdist sensibility a little bit. And even though I don't write in Czech or Slovak, I kind of absorbed a little bit of that absurdist sensibility, but it's very borderline. So you some people see it, some people don't. Some people just think like what the fuck happened there?
Yeah.
But to me, that's something like what once you every culture is absurd. We're all absurd. Yeah. But you can't see the absurdities when you're within them because that's just your social norm.
Yeah.
And it's much easier to see the absurdities when you're out of it. Like when we came to Canada, you know, if somebody knocked on the door and my mom happened to be naked, she'd open the door and say, oh, can you hold on a second and go put a robe on?
Uh-huh.
Like very quickly learned you can't do that in North America. But yeah. Like weird taboos we have about clothing, for example. Or,
oh, I mean, so she would answer the door naked? There would be
just not to keep the person waiting. She'd answer naked, then she'd go and put a robe on.
I wish I was a preacher up there because that would, especially when I was in my teen years, that would have helped me so much. I probably would have stayed a preacher if women were answering the door naked.
You need to go be a preacher in Slovakia. Although I think it's changed there too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of value in that kind of external eye.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
External, but empathetic. You know, not like in order to really criticize somebody, you have to also understand them, but also see them from the outside.
Yeah. And also, also understand the absurd. I mean, I'm so easily irritated, but it cracks me up to no end at the stupid stuff I'm irritated about. So, I already realize I'm an absurd person for being irritated about a lot of things. And I'll be real, like really irritated in the moment, but I'll also kind of realize, okay, this is funny. And then I just write about it. Not that it ever makes it into most of my work, what I'm writing about, but I think it kind of keeps me on that, you know, on that path where when I am crafting something, then I still have that, you know, that love of of, I guess, if we were talking about like clown archetypes, the love of the fool. The fool,
Yeah.
you know, the fool may be, quote, a fool, but the fool actually is the person who dares, you know, who
Yeah.
dares to be
Well,
the fool.
I'm not into tarot at all, but I do love the fact that the fool is both 0 and 22. He's both the lowest and highest card.
Yeah.
Like it, and there's a lot of, you know, even like the Commedia dell'arte, you know, the kind of the almost the archetypes for all characters, you know,
Yeah.
in comedy at least, but also in drama, I think a lot of these come from the Commedia dell'arte. And you have the different types of fools. You have like the zanies, you have, you know, the kind of slapstick fools, but you also have kind of more wise fools. It's been a lot of years since I kind of studied it, but I think every writer will benefit from kind of going and researching the old Commedia dell'arte characters. And
Yeah.
it's amazing how much those characters are still represented in books and film. And it's like those archetypes are human in a lot of ways. And yeah, I've always had a soft spot for the fool.
Yeah.
My first book, The Ugly, it's basically a fool. Like it's Muzhduk the Ugly the Fourth. He's a boulder throwing mountain man from Siberia whose land is stolen by American lawyers, and he goes on a quest to Harvard Law School to learn how to throw words instead of boulders. And so it's basically this fool at Harvard Law School. That's the entire premise of my first novel, was a giant fool goes to Harvard Law School. And so I definitely have a like I think you and I are on the wave, same wavelength there.
Yeah, totally. No, I'm just like sitting there going, "Darn, I wish I was in Vancouver because I'd be wanting to be have a coffee with you tomorrow that would last 4 hours."
Yeah.
The book is called "The Man Who Saw Seconds." The author is Alexander Boldazar. Alexander, thank you so much for coming on the show.
This was really fun. Thank you.
Mieux vaut ne penser à rien que ne pas penser du tout. Rien c'est déjà beaucoup. On se souvient de rien, et puisqu'on oublie tout, rien c'est bien mieux que tout. Mieux vaut ne penser à rien que de penser à vous. Ça ne me vaut rien. Ça ne me vaut rien du tout. Mais comme si de rien n'était, je pense à tout. Ces petits riens qui me venaient de vous. Si c'était trois fois rien entre nous. Évidemment, ça ne fait pas beaucoup. Ce sont ces petits riens que j'ai mis bout à bout, ces petits riens qui me venaient de vous. Mieux vaut pleurer de rien que de rire de tout. Pleurer pour un rien, c'est déjà beaucoup. Mais vous, vous n'avez rien dans le cœur et j'avoue. Je vous envie, je vous en veux beaucoup. Ce sont ces petits riens qui me venaient de vous. Les voulez-vous, tenez, que voulez-vous? Moi, je ne veux pour rien au monde, plus rien de vous. Pour être à vous, faut être à moitié fou.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos, and beyond.